Our second roundtable discussion included Drs. Hossein Borghai, Julie Bramer, Edward Garin, and Ramaswamy Govindan. And in this meeting, we reviewed similar issues as in the first roundtable, but with different cases presented by the general oncologist and additional issues from the survey not reviewed in the first roundtable. As in the first roundtable discussion, this group also unanimously endorsed tissue-based NGS and in some cases liquid biopsies. Dr. Govindan began the discussion.
I would favor using tissue-based testing, using NGS, where you can get not only these days DNA sequencing results, but also RNA sequencing, as well as, you know, the mutation burden multiplex analysis, including PD-L1 testing and MMR mismatch repair deficiency. So it'd be nicer to get a comprehensive analysis of the driver mutations along with the other important pieces of information. That'll be ideal. But in reality, a lot of our patients need quick answers. They want to move on. We can do the liquid NGS or liquid biopsy, but the trouble is that in about 30% of the times, you could have an actionable mutation that may not be revealed in the blood-based assays, particularly for those patients with the low-volume disease, lack of significant visceral involvement. So we have to be mindful of that. If you do both at the same time, clearly you're increasing the cost of these testing, so you have to be mindful of that as well. The other approach is to do serially, you know, PD-L1 testing, EGFR, ALK, ROS, RET, and then if they are negative, do a larger multiplex tissue-based testing. So I think this is an area where you don't have one correct answer, in my view. It depends on the context, depends on the burden of the disease and how sick patients are.
So, Ahasa, getting back to this issue of the sicker patient who you really kind of don't want to wait on, one of the things that I've heard, and I was curious of what your thoughts are about it, is in a patient like that, to maybe start the chemo, but hold off on the IO until you get back mutation status, including EGFR, with the concern that if you start an IO, even if the PD-L1 level is high, and then you find out the patient is EGFR, you're not going to want to give a targeted therapy after an IO. Any thoughts about that?
Sure. That is something that actually I'm doing in my clinic. If I really do have to start somebody on treatment and I don't have the molecular data, my preference is to start with chemo for reasons as you just exactly said. And that's as a result of the newer information that has emerged over the past couple of years, suggesting that if you do use IO and then want to switch to a targeted therapy, you might run into additional toxicities. Not all TKIs seem to do this. Obviously, there is, again, variation in that. But the ones that we use commonly in lung cancer, at least in my experience, such as osimertinib or alectinib or drugs like that, do seem to be associated with a higher risk of additional toxicities. And actually, I've had a couple of patients, unfortunately, who, when I wasn't doing that, ended up having severe toxicity. So I have adjusted my practice to what you suggested. So start the platinum doublet chemo while the molecular testing is pending, and then adjust the treatment based on the results of the molecular testing.
I'm curious what you saw in your two patients. Initially, the report seemed to focus on pneumonitis, and then I started to hear about other things.
Well, I think there are different toxicities that can happen. In my case, I had one person with severe rash that was really difficult to manage. And then I had a patient who developed grade 4 hepatotoxicity. It was, again, very scary, leading to admission and multiple other offshoot of all of that. So in my case, it wasn't pneumonitis, but it was the rash and the hepatitis.
Julie, any comments on this? And any thoughts about how long, theoretically, you'd want to wait before starting targeted therapy after an IO?
Well, I think from an IO standpoint, to start a TKI, I mean, theoretically, it's going to take a long time to get out of your system. So some folks would say 3 months, where the half-life is anywhere between 2 to 3 weeks for just the antibody, and the actual immune effects can last for months. But, you know, in some cases, there's just no way you can wait and you have to start the next drug. Ideally, it would be nice to at least wait through at least one or two half-lives. But again, you cannot guarantee that that heightened toxicity or immune response or potential cross-toxicity, it potentially would happen almost at any point.
Eddie?
I think one of the big questions that I would have in terms of the speed of turnaround is we've actually set our system up where we get an EGFR, ALK, and ROS1 test very early. I think that it is reasonable in my mind to divide tests into ones that you need to have an immediate answer on and ones where if you don't have an immediate answer, you don't think you've harmed the patient by not knowing that result up front.
So, you know, that approach was kind of what I thought was going to made sense until I started to hear about all these other targetable mutations, Govindan, that seem to respond very well. And I see people using first-line therapy, for example, BRAF. So can you really say now that if you put aside ALK, ROS1, and EGFR, that you really have eliminated your first-line targeted therapies? What are you using first-line?
So obviously, you know, if you have a targetable mutation, I tend to go with obviously targeted therapies, definitely for EGFR, ALK, ROS, and RET. BRAF, I typically use this in second-line setting, but I can see the point for using using it in the front-line setting. But back to the issue that you brought up with Eddie, Neil, can we get the tests earlier, sooner, especially the important ones like EGFR, ALK, and ROS? I think one way to do that is to do FISH-based assay for the fusion and then get an EGFR by PCR-based testing. And then if they are negative, then you can send for NGS. That's the current model used in many places. The other approach is to get the NGS results done sooner. And I think I won't be surprised if in a couple of years we can get the turnaround time shortened to about a week or so. As it is now, we can get a blood-based test, NGS results, limited panel, though, within 3 to 4 days. And the tissue-based testing, we could potentially get this in about 7 to 8 days. And technically, it's very, very feasible. So that may be the way to go, to be honest with you, because of tissue problems.
That's what we've started to move towards, getting a liquid-based test as soon as a patient walks into the door, while the tissue-based testing is, for us, it still typically takes 14 days. So in order to try to not miss those targetable changes, we've been using the liquid-based assays while the tissue is being processed and we're waiting for the NGS on the tissue.
And that's exactly what we're doing too, for the same reason. I mean, the liquid panel comes back a lot faster. The tissue in-house takes about 12 to 14 days. So by having the blood-based assay and having most of the actionable mutations, at least you have some idea as to where you're going. I mean, you do have to keep in mind that not all these tests are 100% accurate, so there's always a false negative with the liquid biopsy and with the tumor. But at least in the 70-80% of cases, you have some information to start talking to the patient about, you know, what treatment options you have for them.
So, Eddie, another thing we asked about was the issue of testing in squamous cell. You know, in the past, I kind of really wondered whether it was even worth doing. And then I heard people starting to say, well, you can find targetable mutations. And then I was like, well, is that really squamous or something with that inadequate tissue or et cetera? If you know that you have a squamous cell cancer, Eddie, what do you think should be done in terms of genomic analysis?
Sure. So the guidelines in this setting recommend that you do not necessarily routinely get a broad panel of tests. Now, that has generally been what I have done as well. On the other hand, if you have patients that give you any reason for suspicion that they may have targetable mutations, it's felt that that significantly raises the likelihood that they would have a targetable mutation. And in my own practice, for instance, I have had several people, Asian women with squamous cell cancers who have never been smokers, and almost all of those patients have turned out to have an EGFR mutation. So that's obviously anecdotal, but the current guidelines would suggest that a patient who is a non-smoker, patient who has features that are not consistent with squamous cell carcinoma should undergo testing. But there is a counter argument as well that the more data we get, perhaps we'll be able to learn more about targetable approaches in squamous cell carcinoma. But right now, in patients with a significant smoking history, I have not necessarily been testing.